Good afternoon, everyone. I call the Senate Health and Human Services Committee to order at 1:32 p.m. on Thursday, March 3rd, 2022. Committee members present today are Senator Reinbold, Senator Costello, and myself, Senator Wilson. We do have a quorum to conduct business today. We have two items of business. First, we'll hear an introduction taken by it in public testimony on Senate Bill 175, Healthcare Services, which is sponsored by my office. Then we'll take up Senate Bill 192, Board of Licensed Midwives, sponsored by Senator Kawasaki's office. First, Senator Casella, do we have a motion?
I move the Senate Health and Social Services Committee substitute for Senate Bill 175, version 32-LS1421/India before the committee as our working document.
All right, and I will object to explain the purpose of the CS. This was sort of a rush piece of legislation, but we did have a deadline to meet, and working with a lot of stakeholders, there were some changes that, in the spirit of compromise and working in good faith, we felt that needed to be made to this bill. And before, since the committee has not heard this bill, we thought doing the CS would be an easy way versus doing a sponsor substitute, which would have to go to the floor to be reintroduced. And so this is why we have a committee substitute, and this is the first hearing of the bill, so we don't really have a new CS to explain the changes, but that will be explained in the sectional analysis by my staff, Ms. Martin, as we go on with the bill. So with that, I will remove my objection to see if there's any objection to adopting this CS. Seeing none, the CS version I, Senate Bill 175, has been adopted. And we also want to welcome Senator Hughes and Senator Begich to the committee. And before the bill, I just want to say thank you for everyone that's here. And the COVID pandemic brought many hardships, but as we know, we've had a lot of innovation, as the Chair of Labor and Commerce can attest to. This committee has extensive conversations on these telehealth, both through the disaster bill, the Senate Bill 56, which this committee spent time on addressing, and through Senate Bill 78, the Labor and Commerce Bill, that Senator Costello championed through this committee as well. And this bill capitalizes on both those innovations and conversations through those stakeholders. Access to telehealth services were brought in temporarily during the COVID pandemic, and we want to continue with these flexibilities and make them more permanent statute through SB 75. This improved access to behavioral health, helps address the opioid use disorder, reduces bureaucracy, and makes healthcare possible when an in-person visit doesn't make sense or just isn't an option through many of our Alaska communities. There's a sense of letters in your packet of people who or groups that support this piece of legislation. Some of those include Substance Foundation, ASHNA, the Alaska Association on Developmental Disabilities, Alaska Behavioral Health Association, AARP, Alaska Primary Care Association, Alaska Regional Coalition, Alaska Native Health Board, Family Center Services of Alaska, Set Free, and U.S. Renal Care. So, I think this is, again, SB 75 also creates a new section of telehealth for care providers licensed in the state of Alaska that removes the requirement for in-person visits. Secondly, it allows physicians licensed under another state to deliver telehealth for services within their scope of practice if there's already established physician-patient relationship, if the non-resident physician has given the inpatient physical in-person physical exam, and see if the services are related to ongoing treatment or follow-up care due to a past treatment. Thirdly, this ensures telehealth availability for services related to the opioid use disorder and controlled substances for certain providers, and increases telehealth access for Medicaid beneficiaries, ensuring coverage and ensures payment parity and Medicaid coverage virtually through telehealth modality. SB 175 does not require anyone to deliver or receive services through telehealth, and both provider and patient may choose or limit decline telehealth encounter. And also in the audience here with us is Representative Sponholz, who has a companion bill in the House, and her staff can also answer any additional questions as well. And we'll turn this over to our trusted Health and Human Services Committee aide, Ms. Martin, to walk through the changes to the essay and the sexual analysis.
Sure. For the record, Jasmine Martin, staff to Senator Wilson. So I'm going to cover the sexual analysis for version I, our working document, and I'll note some of the changes as I go through there and then wrap up with some of those changes right at the end. This sectional is a little bit long because almost all of the language in the bill is new language. And so it's just a little bit longer than we normally see with the sectional, but I'll go through it. Section 1 adds a new section, 0.085 telehealth, to our business and professional centralized licensing statutes. So for the first part of that, it allows a healthcare provider licensed in Alaska to provide healthcare services via telehealth without first conducting an in-person visit. And then B, so allows an out-of-state physician to provide healthcare services via telehealth along those parameters Senator Wilson outlines, so some specific parameters there. And then C creates a limit to the telehealth appointment. A provider can't go outside their scope of practice. If they do, they should refer the patient to another provider and cannot bill for services outside their scope of practice. D requires fees charged for telehealth to be no more than fees charged in person. Allows a physician, podiatrist, osteopath, or physician's assistant licensed within the state of Alaska to prescribe controlled substances via telehealth if they comply with Alaska statute. F allows an advanced practice registered nurse licensed in the state of Alaska to prescribe controlled substances via telehealth. And then G prohibits a provider from prescribing controlled substance if they're not allowed to in E&F via telehealth. H removes that burden to document a barrier to an in-person visit and clarifies that the board or department cannot require a healthcare service to be provided from a certain location. I clarifies that nothing in this section requires a provider to provide telehealth services or a patient to use telehealth services. So if the patient says, you know what, I don't want to do this appointment over telehealth, I'm not comfortable with it, or the provider says that, then they are not required to. And then J is just our definitions. Section 2 amends our business and professional licensing prescription statutes, and it removes the in-person requirement. It just is conforming language to conform with some of that APRN language in Section 1. Section 3, and so Section 3 is the language in Section 3 is also repeated in Section 5 and 6. So I'm not going to go through the sectional 3, 5, and 6, but I will go through it for 3 and note what's different in 5 and 6. So Section 3 adds a new section, telehealth, to our health, safety, housing, and human rights and public defenders emergency medical services statutes. And it allows an individual certified or licensed to provide emergency services to provide an emergency service through telehealth. It requires that they stay within their scope of practice and they can't bill beyond their scope of practice. It requires the fees to be no more than the fees charged for in-person visits. It removes the burden to document an attempted in-person visit. And it clarifies that nothing in this section requires the use of telehealth. And then F is the definitions. Section 4 adds a new section, payment for telehealth, to our welfare, social services, and institution medical assistance for needy persons statutes. It requires Medicaid to pay for services by telehealth at the same rate as they would for services provided in person. And it requires that the department adopt regulations for services provided through telehealth. And then it sets certain limits to when the department can limit the modes of telehealth or what can be provided by telehealth. It requires all telehealth services to comply with HIPAA, and then D is the definitions. Section 5 and Section 6, again, are identical almost to Section 3, except for Section 5 adds the new section to our welfare, social services, and institutions, mental health sections of law. And so it applies to entities which are approved to receive grant funding by the Department of Health and Social Services to deliver community health services. Section 6, again, identical to Section 5 and Section 3, adds a new section to Welfare, Social Services, and Institutions, Uniform Alcoholism and Intoxication Act. It applies to public and private treatment facilities approved by the Department of Health and Social Services to deliver services designated under AS 473740 through 270, addressing substance abuse disorder. And then sections 7 through 10 amend on codify law to instruct the Department of Health and Social Services to submit an amendment to the state plan to seek approval from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services if needed, and provides for an immediate effective date for the other areas of the bill. And then for changes, and again, we didn't hear the bill in its original form, and so, you know, if I'll be a little bit brief on the changes. But one of the most important things that it did there was it limited that telehealth to in-state providers, except for that carve-out for the out-of-state physicians and that very specific carve-out for the out-of-state physicians. It also cleaned up provisions regarding medication-assisted treatment, and then removed language deemed unnecessary to ensure telehealth delivery of medication-assisted treatment, and revised the prescribing authority to separate out APRNs, for the physician, podiatrist, osteopath, and physician's assistants, and separated them from the APRNs, so they have their two sections in there as opposed to being lumped in together. It doesn't change the prescription scope for either of these providers. And then, so that was section one, some of the changes there. Section three, remove that requirement to document attempts at in-person visits. Section four, the changes there, it added language in subsection B, line 13, to ensure the department must revise regulatory language to include telehealth and definition of visit. And then section five through six were new sections, adding telehealth provisions to entities in Title 47. This authority wasn't to deliver telehealth wasn't previously addressed in version A because there's no they were not applicable to the provisions in Title 8 or the Alaska Medicaid provisions in Title 47. Same thing, Section 5, Section 6, to include those entities as were in Section 3, were added, and that is my changes there from the first to the second and that sectional analysis.
Thank you, Ms. Martin. Before we go to questions, just letting the committee know, we do have Director Chambers here from the Division of Corporations Business and Professional Licensing. He's here in person. We have Renee Gearhart, the Division of Healthcare Services from Department of Health and Human Services, online. We have Jennifer Moreau Johnson, the Director of Division of Behavioral Health, on the phone. And Director John Lee, the Division of Senior and Disability Services, on the phone as well. Any questions from committee members before we go to invite testimony? Senator Reinbold.
Okay, thank you. This is our first time seeing the bill, so I'm going to just ask in layman's term for people who are listening, what does this bill do that wouldn't allow you to do before? I believe it's the in-person visit, and the reason why that's so important to me is because when Liz Vasquez, Representative Vasquez, got telehealth through, the Alaskan physicians were absolutely adamant on having that in-person visit, so I see that's being removed. So beside that being removed, just at a high level, you should just, in a sentence or two, say what will this allow to do that wasn't allowed before?
So that burden to document an attempt at an in-person visit is removed, and also the payment parity for telehealth and in-person visits.
Okay, through the chair?
Yes.
Okay, so payment parity, you need to, you know, this is in layman's terms, I've asked, and is there anything about prescribing medications, telehealth, or anything like that? Because I think it does more than what you said, so.
Yep, sorry. Yes, there is also.
the record. Cindy Reinbolt.
Okay, so Mr. Chairman, my first question is I believe it's House Bill 275 and SB 175 identical, because fiscal note is talking to two different bills. Fiscal note.
Yes. Just
want clarification.
265.
Correct.
And yes, it's the same bill, and I believe we will, you know, just briefly touch base on some of the notes that, for some reason, maybe someone at the Division of Healthcare Services can talk about the notes and why additional person is needed for services that they're already providing. Maybe we can ask Renee Gearhart to talk about that. Gearhart.
Good afternoon, everybody. This is Renee Gearhart, Director of Healthcare Services. There's a little bit of confusion, it seems, between the what's being asked and what we were going to be presenting. But as far as the position, are you looking specifically what we were looking at is with some of the pieces of this bill, we would be keeping the flexibilities that were offered through the public health emergency and adding those in. It would change some of the modalities. My other colleagues from sister divisions are online from behavioral health and senior and disabilities. Additional staffing really is just to ensure the quality assurance of once these things go in place. It would require some regulation changes, so that is staff time, and some additional quality assurance reviews on post-payment. So those are just really minimal compared to the flexibilities that would be brought into play with the enhancement and continuing some of the flexibilities of the telehealth. There would also be potentially some methodology changes to rates that would be paid. So again, the staffing pattern is pretty minimal compared to the flexibilities that would continue. I would turn it over to my colleagues and sister divisions at the department if they have anything else to add to that.
Well, just wondering, wouldn't you wait to see if there's actual additional cost to the administration versus, because looking through the note, it doesn't state how many more patients would use telehealth as a modality versus inpatient. And it seems that you're adding this in a cost in perpetuity, not just a one-time charge. This goes out into outgoing FY years of a total new position. But you're stated that this is only going to be a temporary, so why not just see those costs or just add it in a supplemental? I guess that's my question for you, and I guess for behavioral health, for Jennifer Moreau Johnson as well.
Let's see. So again, this is Director Gayhart, Healthcare Services, Department of Health and Social Services, through the chair. In response to that, we are looking at and have worked with Rep. Von Holtz and others on what would potentially be added per this Senate bill and its companion House bill, which comes up next. If these were added in, it does, the flexibilities that have been put in place since the pandemic have added many recipients to telehealth. If we put those into permanent status, it requires additional regs, it requires edits to the system, and it requires post-payment review of those claims. Right now, with the pandemic and the flexibilities that we have with that, those are waived by CMS, which reimburses us for the services we provide to recipients through providers. But if we were to make that permanent, it does take staff to put those regulations in place, put those edits in place, put the system in place, and do that post-payment review. And again, I'd turn it over to my colleagues and other divisions. They would have similar work efforts as well.
Yeah, but I guess my question would be, in terms of the regulations, and this is something that we can consider later on, is that that's not going to happen in FY 27-28. I mean, those are should be hopefully done within a two-year process. And so I just have some concerns about the ongoing cost of this piece of legislation that doesn't seem really feasible. Jennifer Johnson-Giroux, do you have anything to add?
Hi there, Chair Wilson. For the record, this is Jennifer Moreau, the Director of the Division of Behavioral Health. And may I just check in and make sure that you can hear me?
Yes, please continue.
Great. Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity to speak to this. The Division of Behavioral Health is very interested in supporting access to care, and part of our mission is to ensure that the care is effective and that we are, you know, helping to assure for quality outcomes. So the position, the full-time position that the Division of Behavioral Health wrote a fiscal note to support is to, you know, review and monitor for the clinical appropriateness of the services, to make sure that we're doing ongoing surveillance on national best practices related to telehealth, and, you know, to make sure that we are, you know, not only supporting the access aspect of this proposed legislation, but the quality outcome. We imagine that, you know, this, that telehealth will be a method of delivery that we'll be developing over time, and so we feel that position would be full-time and permanent to stay abreast of national best practices and ensure quality.
And
thank you.
I guess the question I would have is, are you not doing that now?
Senator Wilson, thank you very much. Mr. Chuck Moreau for the record. We are doing that now, but this bill proposes language that would put, you know, the administration of this service through the regulatory process that we feel we would need the additional support to manage.
All right. Thank you. Any other questions? Senator Baggage.
I think I'll just follow that up and say, what is the additional work then that you're going to see that will be required by the legislation? You just said that you do it now. You write new regs 1 year. And I guess I have to share Senator Wilson's confusion. I'm not sure what the extra work is here. The monitoring is happening now. You're monitoring telehealth now. So what would be the additional work?
Through the chair, Senator Baggage. This is Jennifer Moreau, the Director of the Division of Behavioral Health. Some of the language in the proposed legislation is around substantial medical evidence, and because this is an emerging platform, we really want to make sure that we're getting the quality right. So this is a bill that proposes a lot of focus on behavioral health through telehealth, which again, we welcome the access, but we just want to make sure we're getting the quality right. The Division of Behavioral Health is a small division, and we've taken on a lot of work through the implementation of the 1115 and the standing up of the Administrative Services Organization. So we really just want to ensure that we are giving this its due support.
What?
Thank you.
Yeah, follow-ups
in your baggage?
Yeah, thank you. Just just a couple comments on just that. Maybe 1 year follow-up. 2 years follow-up, 5 years follow-up? I don't understand. I'm just confused by the nature of the fiscal note requiring that, especially in a bill that when enacted, will eventually reduce documentation, not increase documentation. So I'm just not comfortable with this fiscal note. I think it's my perception that this fiscal note is inflated by at least $500,000 potentially. And so I guess what I'd suggest is that a more clear definition of how long it takes to determine whether you're doing it right or wrong is. I suspect that it's maybe a year, year and a half at most. If it's, otherwise I don't see why we need the full-time position over time. I just don't see it. So, we can differ on that, but I'm just not seeing that.
Thank you, Senator Baggage. Senator Hughes.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. Just like the concerns have been expressed regarding the fiscal note as it pertains to the state budget, I've got a concern as far as the cost as it pertains to Alaskans. Because, and this is for you, the bill sponsor, or for Jasmine, because what we're doing here in several sections, if you're basically saying that the fees for these services provided through telehealth can be the same as what they are in person. And I remember when telehealth, when we first started talking about it way, way back when we had the telecarts in the rural villages before I was in the legislature, And we were talking about how telehealth was going to help reduce healthcare costs in this state. And I understand for certain aspects of a clinic or of a provider's office may not change, but there is definitely some savings. For instance, if a physician is meeting with a patient through a telehealth, the medical assistant isn't in the room performing services, taking the blood pressure, doing the various things. There is just lower overhead, and yet we are saying that we're going to allow fees that equal what it would be if they were in the office. And I think this is to the detriment of Alaskans, and we've got a problem with our healthcare costs in this state. So I guess I want to understand why we are saying they can charge the same thing. I would, you know, if I'm a patient and I don't feel like maybe I need the exam and my doctor agrees that it could be taken care of over the phone or by telehealth, I would hope that there would be a bit of a saving. So can we explain, can you please explain why we're still going to be charging the patient the same as if they were in person?
Yeah. You know, our office was looking through that, and I will pass this out to other committee members. We just didn't have a complete list at the time. And going through this and working with other telehealth providers during a Medicaid policy conference, it was that telehealth, for two reasons. One, to help incentivize the use of telehealth, most inpatient doctors would prefer to keep, just for the profitability of their practice, to keep having patients be seen inpatient. That's one statistic. The other one, using, and I said we'll pass around some documents, this is the understanding, the case for telehealth for payment parity that we got from NCSL, and we've tasked them to sort of provide us some data and research why, or, you know, the case for payment parity with telehealth. And, you know, some of it was the initial cost for some of the rural community health providers in the nation to provide telehealth, allowing them to recoup the cost and investment of telehealth, because not everyone has the capability or software to make sure that they meet some of the privacy and the security demands. And, you know, I'll just read this here, that payment parity is particularly important for small practice located in underserved communities who may not have the financial means to offer telehealth if reimbursement is substantially lower. And so our office is looking at drafting an amendment to have a payment parity sunset, and would be taking that into consideration as well to allow entities to do that, because I know that was a concern when the telehealth bill was on the Senate side, and we'd be working with the House sponsor as well to make sure that we can come up with something that would, and the stakeholders, that something that would work well to try to, I truly understand your need, and I would agree with those comments too, Sandra Hughes.
Okay, thank you for that clarification, and that makes sense. I appreciate your addressing that, because not only does it impact the individual Alaskan who may need an appointment, but it's going to be reflected in our budget too as we pay for Medicaid. So we should see some savings when people choose telehealth over in-person visits, even to our Medicaid budget. I do have another question as well, Mr. Chair.
Yes.
And allow me to find where it is. So in the work draft on page 6, and actually I'm thinking, is this, I'm assuming this is HESS and not Department of Commerce, but on line 9 and following lines, we're talking about the department having responsibility for deciding what will be covered, not covered, excluded, and determining, for instance, whether the service can be safely provided, et cetera. And I'm just wondering, because I think, like, the medical board is deciding what doctors can and cannot do. The nursing board is deciding what the nurse practitioners can and cannot do. So I'm just wondering how this is going to work for the department to be deciding what's appropriate as far as the service delivered by telehealth. I would think the medical board would want to decide that. So how would that work?
Yeah, and this is mostly for reimbursable services. So not every, for example, Medicaid reimbursable service is offered through, and I'll ask Jennifer Johnson-Giroux to talk about this for behavioral health. You know, you may have an inpatient visit, but a case management visit by certain providers may not be covered through Medicaid, but may be covered through another private insurance. So this is just giving them the flexibility to say which modality of service or which service being provided will be reimbursed, and giving the state that option through regulations as it's currently is in regulations now, through those CPT codes of medical providers and through different behavioral health providers have different codes for different rates. And this will give them the availability to set those rates and set which codes are set for reimbursable services in the state of Alaska by telehealth. Jennifer Giroux, would you be able to help?
Hi, Chair. Thank you. I believe that you stated it correctly, that the language is providing the department the authority to establish regulations for reimbursement and maintaining like reimbursement for like services to the extent possible. So I believe you stated that correctly, Chair.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, and I have one more question.
Yes, Senator Hughes.
So at the very beginning, in Section 1, we're stating that in-state providers may use telehealth without first having a physical exam of the patient, but out-of-state providers would have to have an in-person medical exam before they could provide those services. So I'm just wondering about the constitutional aspects of that, treating out-of-state providers differently, having different requirements depending if someone's inside our borders or not. Is there a constitutional problem with that?
No, we do not believe so, and Director Chambers can probably maybe provide a little bit more information on that. I believe that's one of our licensing requirements for doctors to prescribe, and I think we're just trying to create more of a parity of in-state and out-of-state physicians. Director Chambers.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Sarah Chambers, Director of the Division of Corporations, Business, and Professional Licensing. And because my understanding is that because this bill would eliminate licensure for out-of-state providers, that these are some of the side rails that are being put on the ability to provide that service. So right now, out-of-state providers, in order to practice on an Alaskan via telehealth, would need to have an Alaska license. This bill would allow them to do that if they are licensed in another state, and they would not have to get an Alaska license, but they would have to follow these rules. So this puts those side rails on to say you need to have that first visit. An example is a story we heard a lot during COVID, which was that people who had a previous relationship with a Seattle-based doctor, maybe they were a cancer patient or someone who needed specialty care in Seattle, could no longer travel to Seattle, or it was a great expense, or that their health, it wasn't safe for them in their condition to travel. But they couldn't receive that service unless the physician went through the process of getting an Alaska license, which they may only need for that one patient. So this is an attempt to close that, to sort of put side rails on that situation so providers don't need to have that license, but they do need to follow the law.
Thank you, Director. I'm sorry, Senator Hughes.
Yeah, I don't want Sarah's job. Thank you very much. So, and that makes sense. I hadn't realized that, but I'm also wondering, are we possibly opening the door to a physician to come live in Alaska who's not licensed in our state to be providing healthcare services on an ongoing basis by telehealth to Alaskans? I guess they couldn't. I'm just wondering if we need to say a physician licensed in another state and practicing from another state or something, or could we possibly be opening the door? I'm not sure a physician, an out-of-state physician, would want to do that, but it might be a way that they, you know, maybe they would choose not to get an Alaskan license and be practicing up here and solely telehealth.
I think that would be pretty hard. I think Director Chambers would have this answer, but I think some of the requirements under the 1, 2, and 3 you know, I guess if you had a physician based in Seattle that moved to Alaska, but then you'd be practicing within the state of Alaska, which would require you to have a state of Alaska medical license.
Okay. But. Through the chair, Senator Hughes, yes, the intent is to have a bifurcated system where in Alaska, a person who's practicing in Alaska would be required to still have that Alaska license. But that's a great point that I think that the sponsor's office and I can take a look at and just make sure that it's really clear. So 5 years from now, the intent isn't lost and we don't have a level of confusion in our office about when a license is required or not.
Thank you.
We can definitely add that to our list of possible amendments. At this point, I just want to be aware of the time. We do have two folks on for invited testimony. Nancy Merriman, if you can state your name and affiliation for the record and provide a short invited testimony.
All right. Thank you. Thank you, Chair Wilson and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Nancy Merriman, and I'm the Executive Director of the Alaska Primary Care Association. And I'm pleased to join you today in support of SB 175. The Alaska Primary Care Association, or APCA, supports the operations and development of Alaska's 29 federally qualified health centers, also known as community health centers, or FQHCs. Health centers provide comprehensive whole person care, which includes medical, dental, behavioral, pharmacy, and care coordination services. APCA and Alaska's health centers support SB 175 because it increases access to primary care and behavioral health services, and it expands telehealth in this state. This legislation does several things that are important to health centers. First, it includes a range of telehealth modalities, including audio only, both now and into the future. Second, it allows patients and providers to engage in telehealth services outside a clinic setting if they so choose. And third, it provides adequate reimbursement for telehealth visits, providing new points of access to whole person care, including behavioral health and substance use disorder treatment. In 2020, health centers served 105,000 patients through 450,000 visits. Telehealth and substance use disorder services are our fastest growing area of service. And of those visits, 40% were accommodated via telehealth. In the subspecialty area of substance use disorder services, 45% visits were via telehealth. And the temporary telehealth policy changes have benefited health centers, because they have allowed health centers to be recognized as telehealth treating providers, to furnish some behavioral health services via audio-only technology, and to be paid for telehealth services furnished to Medicaid beneficiaries under the health center's bundled payment reimbursement model. Health centers serve hard-to-reach communities. The majority of health center patients experience challenges in accessing health care that include long distances to reach local providers, cost of care, transportation, language, and cultural barriers. In Alaska, over half of our patients are from racial or ethnic minorities, a majority are low income, and most patients live in rural communities. Health centers best serve their patient populations if they have the ability to use technology to meet their patients where they are at. Additionally, workforce shortages, particularly in behavioral health providers, impact health centers uniquely as nonprofit safety net providers, and telehealth allows health centers to use their clinical workforce most nimbly. In 2021, a cohort of health centers reported that of their telehealth interactions, 59% occurred by phone and 40% by audio or video. Through the pandemic, demand for telehealth, telebehavioral health now represents 35% of all telehealth usage. Health centers have witnessed how telehealth has provided stronger continuity of care for patients, reduced travel costs, and has resulted in fewer dropped visits and less delayed and more costly care. And we understand that delivering quality, whole person care ultimately leads to better health outcomes, saves lives, and in the long run, saves on cost. So on behalf of the Alaska Primary Care Association and health centers across the state, I urge you to support SB 175, and we appreciate your support.
Thank you, Ms. Merriman. Is there any questions?
Mr. Chairman, I have questions, but I'm not sure if she's the right person to ask. It's a more of a general. She just had a really, really nice presentation, I believe, and she seemed to have a real good grasp on the bill. I don't know if she's the right person to ask three very basic questions or not to.
We can go ahead and ask, and we'll see if I can answer them.
Okay, and I wish I would have had time to spend with somebody ahead of time on this bill, but and that's my fault. So I apologize for that, because I'm doing a lot of on-the-job learning in this bill today. But the bottom line is, I made a commitment when I supported telehealth about 5 or 6 years ago that I would never undermine Alaska physicians. So I'm really thankful that the patient has to have an established relationship with a physician in Alaska. So I think that's really, really good. What I want to make sure that all these people who have set up clinics and maybe struggling, I just want to make sure that that all these patients aren't going to run outside and just do telemedicine and kind of leave our local doctors high and dry. So if someone could answer that would be helpful.
Ms. Merriman, I think you might be the best person to answer that. Do you feel that some of the providers would have that concern within the community health center world?
Through the chair, Senator Reinbold, I think that the protections in this bill are there to establish patient-provider relationships, and that relationship is protected.
Yes, Senator Reinbold.
I'll say something positive about the bill, and I mean, people in this committee know this about me, but one reason I am supportive of this bill is because I know of patients that are getting sent down to Washington and they're trying to force the jab on them, the COVID shot, before they get treatment. So this would prevent that. And so I will tell you that is one motivating factor for me to support the bill. But I have two other questions. One, we've been dealing with an opioid crisis forever, it seems like, up here in Alaska. I just want to make sure this doesn't increase access to controlled substance that could put, you know, another crisis on the horizon that we've been dealing with and we are still dealing with in the state of Alaska.
And I can answer that. No, we still have the state statutes and laws that out-of-state physicians, providers would still have to follow. And we can clarify that and make sure that that is, we'll get an interpretation on that. Make sure that they still, out-of-state entities will still have to follow the prescribing rules within the state of Alaska in terms of our opioid use statutes that we did pass a few years ago.
Okay, and one more, Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Senator Reinbold.
And I believe we had like a 7-day on that. You know, there was a 7-day max days on that opioid. This is just a super important issue because so many people get easily addicted to those controlled substances, and we just don't want to exacerbate that problem. The third question, and I hope it's an appropriate question to ask, but House Bill 172 and SB 124, this doesn't mirror any of that in any way. This bill doesn't complement or mirror that bill in any way. It's the psychotropic medication bill with the subacute medical facilities. I just want to make sure.
Yes, that's correct. No.
Okay. Wanted to just validate that. And then in regards to just the local physicians assistants, nurse practitioners, I know they're for primary care associates. I know they testified, but and I know she said she worked with medical health, the primary care physicians, but I do think it's really important, just because of the commitment I made, I just need to make sure that there's a lot of support from Alaskan physicians, Alaska providers for this bill, and there likely could be. I'm just not positive. But anyway, thank you, Mr. Chairman.
Thank you, and I think we'll get through some of that here in the testimony here. Our next invited testimony is John Solomon. If you could state your affiliation for the record and begin your invited testimony.
Thank you, Senator Wilson. My name's John Solomon. I'm the Director of Behavioral Health for the Manilik Association. We serve the Northwest Arctic and also a village in the North Slope. But we are basically the only game in town for folks in the Northwest Arctic. And I'm not just an administrator. I actually started as a counselor flying in with a backpack and a sleeping bag into villages to see clients. And I wanted to speak specifically to our region and how important telehealth has been, and hopefully it kind of encapsulates what's going on in rural Alaska. In the fact that before we had, you know, all these barriers to get people into treatment that were just logistical barriers, and when the telehealth flexibilities went through, we actually saw an explosion in clients asking for care through telehealth, where we went from where our substance use groups went up 800% in 6 months. And that's not to say that there were 800% new folks with substance use disorders. It was that these people were waiting and wanted care, but the way that we had to provide it was just not able to get that to them. And we went from 5 clients in our substance use program to 70 regular clients ongoing now. And I think it's important that the telephonic part is part of the bill, and I'm so happy to support this bill, because the telephonic part is what matters for rural Alaska. We have clients that we have clinics that don't have BHAs in it. We have there's organizations that have clinics that aren't staffed. And so having that telephonic option is really the way that we can actually get care. So for us, it's not about a better or best practice. It's really about care or no care for Alaskans. And so I also wanted to speak to one of the things that we've been able to do is develop local workforce in our villages. We now have BHAs that can provide care to other villages, where before that, with the logistical barriers, they weren't able to. So we've been able to hire more BHAs, and we hope to fill out the rest of our open positions that way. So I just wanted to thank you for having me come and talk, and just say that Manilik Association for sure is a very strong supporter of this bill, and I would be happy to answer any questions as it relates to us. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Solomon. And for the record, BHA, Behavioral Health Associate?
Yeah, Behavioral Health Aide. That's a position that in the tribal health organizations that they're like village-based counselors that we can access in those villages.
All right, thank you. Any questions, Mr. Solomon? Seeing none, thank you for providing your testimony today. We'll now open it up for public testimony. Just for folks, we do have a lot of folks online. If you submitted a letter, feel free to reference that letter. But we do have a lot, and so we're going to ask members, people, if they can keep their testimony relatively short. You have 2 minutes. First, we will go to Ms. Suzanne Isha Reagan.
Hello. Can you hear me okay?
Yes, we can. If you can provide your testimony and plan 2 minutes.
My name is Suzanne Ishii Regan, and I called in to give perspective from a family who has benefited from telehealth. I'd like to thank the chair and the committee for this opportunity, and I'd also like to thank the state of Alaska and SDS for a quick pivot to flexibility early in the pandemic, which helped protect many vulnerable Alaskans. I'm testifying on behalf of myself and my family. We have a family member who uses a ventilator. He has a tracheotomy. He also experiences a primary immune deficiency. The ability to access telehealth has helped us all stay connected to our doctors, because in addition to our family member, my husband and I are also trying to and tried very hard during the height of the pandemic to avoid infection, so that we didn't bring anything home, in particular prior to vaccination, but even following, because fortunately there is a vaccination, but unfortunately our family member has an immunocompromised situation that calls into question how effective that vaccination and the booster is for him. It provided an opportunity for first-time access to services when he needed to transition to a new provider. It also reduced barriers for us to continue his medical care plan as well as our own. It helped because, again, there was high risk of COVID infection that we simply couldn't, run. He also has a mobility issue, and it helped us with weather. There was extreme cold, which is extremely difficult for somebody who is on a ventilator. Extreme snow and extreme ice. And in addition to that.
And Suzanne, if you could wrap up your testimony, your 2 minutes is up.
In addition, it provided us an opportunity to be able to hear care providers better than we could when everybody was masked, as is necessary and required by protocol for the ventilators. Thank you very, very much for this opportunity.
Thank you, Suzanne, for your testimony today. Next, we have Sarah Eleason. If you could start your testimony and plan 2 minutes. Are you with us, Sarah? You may have us on mute.
I'm sorry, I didn't hear you.
Okay. Yes, Sarah, if you can start your testimony and plan 2 minutes for your testimony.
Okay, I'll try to keep it short. I wrote a nice little speech, and now I found that I can't see it to read it to you. My name is Sarah Eliason. I'm a retired school teacher and 96 years old. I live in Eagle River, and this ability to go to my doctor, I have to back up and say, Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, I thank you very much for the time to be here. But I am so intent on letting you know what it has meant to me to be able to stay in my home and have the attention from my doctor. I am losing my vision. I am declared legally blind at this point in time, and I have the disability of not being able to walk without a walker. Even if I had public transportation in Eagle River, I couldn't use it anymore because I can't see to get to places. So that it is, and I don't feel that I should have to ask my children and my grandchildren and my friends to take time off from their activities to take me to the doctor. I've led, you know, a very independent life. It's very difficult to have to ask people to take you to do things. And I'm sure that I am not the only person, not only in the Eagle River, Chugiak, Peters Creek area, who has difficulty getting to Anchorage to see a doctor. But I'm sure it's true in the little towns all along the rail belt and into the rural villages that folks have an opportunity to take care of their health. And for me to have had the ability during the COVID bit to stay at home and not have to bother about how I was going to get to town, and yet to have the same attention from my doctor. And if I may speak to something that you all have been talking about, even though the doctor does not see you in person, his assistant in his office is still there to back him up. And the assistant is making the arrangements for the telephone call and keeping the records. And
Ms.
he's
Sarah?
Not going to save any money by not having an assistant to take the blood pressure and the oxygen level. That's just my comment, maybe not necessary. But I do want to ask you all to please consider this as a permanent thing for old folks and disabled folks and anybody who needs it in Alaska. Because, as you all have said, it just is impossible for some folks to get to their doctors. I thank you for the time, and I hope that you will find it in your hearts and your wisdom to keep this thing going, because we need it. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Sarah. Next, we'll go to Cody Chip. If you can provide a few moments of testimony.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for taking the time. It's Cody Chip. I'm the Director of Behavioral Health for the Alaska Native Tribal Health Consortium. Just want to say the telehealth opportunity or the flexibility that have come with the COVID, as Mr. Solomon mentioned from Manila earlier, has just really created the ability to provide greater access to care. And when we recently launched a telehealth behavioral health clinic due to the needs related to COVID and the distress and how people's lives have been upended. Through that clinic launch, we also try to be data-driven and set up the gold standard outcomes and clinical measurement called the OQ45. Anyway, our one thing that we have found is not only is telehealth accessible, it's also safe and effective. Our clinical outcomes are showing equal to or greater than national averages, and our client satisfaction surveys people are just reporting time and again how grateful they are to be able to access services that they previously hadn't had access to before, actually how easy it was to use, how easy it was to use the telehealth system, and that the ability to do that has just really increased their ability to access care. I also just want to highlight that the state's fiscal analysis has also shown that it could actually save the state money. As noted in their Medicaid reform report in response to SB 74, as well as I think it saves people time and money also as individuals, for example, instead of having to, you know, go from Glen Allen to Wasilla to do a follow-up appointment with a specialist or Willow to Wasilla, you know, people aren't spending an hour or 2 hours in a car or packing up family or packing up kids to go to these appointments. They can actually meet with their provider and get adequate, not more than adequate, safe and effective care to meet their needs. So, again, thank you for your time and appreciate how you're looking for the betterment of all Alaskans.
Thank you. At this time, I know there's still folks online waiting to testify for this bill. We will have this bill back before the committee again to continue public testimony. But this time, we do have another item on today's business, and we will encourage folks, if you have not submitted a letter or would like to submit public testimony, feel free to do so at shss@akleg.gov, and we will bring this bill back before the committee to continue public testimony on the bill before we do a final closeout. Is anyone in the room in Juneau? Are you here to testify? Anyone on? Okay. Just want to make sure if anyone came down that we gave them the opportunity to also testify as well. So we will go ahead and close public testimony at this time on this bill, and we'll take an at ease for a transition for the next presenter. We are back on the record. Our next item of business before us is Senate Bill 192. We do have the bill sponsor, staff, Mr. Joe Hayes, and the sponsor's internet, as he declaimed, but I think he meant to say intern, is before the committee as well. And if Mr. Hayes would like to introduce the bill on the behalf of the Senate sponsor, Senator Kawasaki. And the floor is yours.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Joe Hayes, staff to Senator Kawasaki, and I will introduce the sponsor statement to Senate Bill 192, and then our intern, Sherry Bowman, will do a very long sectional analysis. So if you guys want that cut down, we'll be more than happy to do that. Okay, so Senate Bill 192, an act relating to midwives and the practice of midwifery, relating to apprentice midwives, relating to the license of midwives, relating to insurance requirements for the practice of midwifery, and providing an effective date. So Senate Bill 192 would establish licensing of certified professional midwives in Alaska and create a governing board to develop licensing procedures and review licensing applications and renewals. Currently, Alaska has legislation regarding the certification of direct entry midwives. This bill would institute licensing requirements and regulations for certified professional midwives to be formed in conjunction with a nationally recognized midwife organization. The bill also requires that licensed midwives have basic life support certification for health care providers and certification in neonatal resuscitation and knowledge of and experience with non-hospital-based births. These recommendations would be in addition to a required background in health-related field other than nursing and graduation from a master's level midwifery education program. This bill will also create a board of licensed midwives from the current board of certified direct entry midwives. The new board will adopt standards and regulations for licensed midwives that are in the public interest and in compliance with the Administrative Procedures Act. The board will review license applications and renewals for midwives in the state of Alaska and establish insurance provisions. The board will help to develop future legislation specific to licensed midwives that will clarify these standards and regulations. So Senate Bill 192 is important for ensuring safer at-home births and improving prepartum and postpartum care for mothers and infants. And I ask for your consideration and support for 182 to allow the state licensing of certified professional midwives and formation of a governing board to oversee the standards and regulations for licensed midwives. So we'll go into the sectional and then we'll be open for questions.
Through the chair, I'm Sherry Bowman, intern for Senator Kawasaki, and I will be reading the sectional analysis for Senate Bill 192, an act relating to midwives and the practice of midwifery, relating to apprentice midwives, relating to the licensing of midwives, relating to insurance requirements for the practice of midwifery, and providing for an effective date. Section 1 is uncodified law providing legislative intent to preserve the right of women to deliver children at home with licensed midwives. Section 2 amends AS 8117, subsection 17, to change the board name from certified direct entry to licensed midwives. Section 3 amends AS 8210, subsection A, to explain who can practice and what type of professional letters or title shall appear. Section 4 amends AS 8310, subsection C8, to change the name certified direct entry to licensed midwives, and adds an effective date of June 30, 2023. Section 5 amends AS 864370 to explain how licensed midwives are recognized with or without compensation and how licensed midwives are defined in AS 865190. Section 6 amends AS 865-10, subsection A, to establish the Board of Licensed Midwives. Section 7 amends AS 865-10, subsection B, to define who can be members of the Licensed Midwife Board. Section 8 amends AS 865-30 to address the powers and duties of the Board of Midwives. Section 9 amends AS 865-40 to add a new subsection on activities which the board cannot adopt by regulations, to include B and C. Subsection B requires a person to have a nursing degree or diploma to be licensed under this chapter. It requires a licensed midwife to practice midwifery under the supervision of or collaboration with another healthcare provider or a healthcare facility. It requires a licensed midwife to enter into an agreement, whether written, oral, or in another form, with another healthcare provider or a healthcare facility. Limits the location where a licensed midwife may practice midwifery. Subsection C adds definitions of healthcare facility and healthcare provider as identified in AS 1835, 399, and AS 965, 300, respectively. Section 10 amends AS 865-50 to address the qualifications needed to be a licensed midwife in Alaska. Line 1 reads, holds a valid certified professional midwife certificate if the certificate is issued by a nationally recognized midwife organization recognized by the board and the requirements for the certificate are consistent with this chapter. Line 2 is added and reads, applies on a form provided by the board. Lines 2 and 3 are renumbered as 3 and 4. Line 4 is renumbered as line 5 and adds, is certified in basic life support for healthcare provider, and adds the word and. Line 5 is renumbered as line 6 and adds, is certified in the interventions used at the time of birth to support the establishment of breathing and circulation of the newborn. Section 11 amends AS 865-80 to explain procedures for renewal of midwifery license. Section 12 amends AS 865-90, subsection A, to allow the midwifery board to issue permits to midwife apprentices who have satisfied the education, training, and apprenticeship that is deemed by the board to be in the public interest and recognized by a national commissioner to adopt regulations to implement and interpret the act. Section 13 amends AS 865-110 to address grounds of discipline, suspension, or revocation of certification for licensed midwives. Section 14 amends AS 865-120, subsection A, to give the board the authority to impose discipline to include revocation or suspension of midwives' licenses for those who break any code of conduct. Section 15 amends ASH 65-120 subsection D to give the board the ability to reinstate a license after appeal if a person proves to be able to practice with reasonable skill and safety. Section 16 amends AS 865-140 to allow the board to adopt regulations to licensed midwives after consultation with a nationally recognized midwife organization. The regulations would have to conform to the public interest. Section 17 amends AS 865-150 to add a new subsection to read, subsection B. A licensed midwife may practice midwifery without being under the supervision of or collaborating with another healthcare provider or a healthcare facility. Subsection C. A licensed midwife may practice midwifery without entering into a written or other form of agreement with another healthcare provider or a healthcare facility. Subsection D. A licensed midwife may provide services using audio, video, or other electronic media for the purpose of diagnosis, consultation, or treatment. Section 18 amends AS 865-150 to give specification that a non-licensed midwife recognized under AS 865-150 cannot receive compensation. Section 19 amends AS 865-160 to address who can be called a licensed midwife and the penalties established for a person who uses the title illegally. Section 20 amends AS 865-170 to exclude licensed physicians and advanced practice registered nurses. Section 21 amends AS 865-180 to explain the responsibility of care if not transferred from a licensed midwife to a licensed physician until the patient is physically within the physician's care. Section 22 amends AS 865-190 subsection 1 to explain the board being discussed as for licensed midwives. Section 23 amends AS 865-190 subsection 3 to define the practice of midwifery to include preconception, pregnancy, the first postpartum year, and well baby care for the infant through the age of 6 weeks. Section 24 amends AS 865-190 by adding a new paragraph to read. Licensed midwife means a midwife who is licensed under this chapter to practice midwifery, and midwife means a person who practices midwifery. Section 25 amends AS 965-300, subsection C1, to add licensed midwives as a healthcare provider. Section 26 amends AS 1142-470, subsection 1, to add licensed midwives as a healthcare worker. Section 27 amends AS 1820-95, subsection E2, to add licensed midwives as a licensed staff member under AS 864. Section 28 amends AS 1850-165, subsection B, to add licensed midwives to the responsibilities of the registrar to distribute information to. Section 29 amends AS 213690, subsection D, to add licensed midwives as a person who cannot practice or permit unfair discrimination against a person who provides services covered under a group health insurance that extends coverage on an expense-incurred basis. Section 30 amends AS 21, 42, 355 by adding a new subsection that reads, subsection C. If a health care insurance plan or an accepted benefits policy or contract provides indemnity for the cost of services of a physician provided to women during preconception, pregnancy, childbirth, and the period after childbirth up to 1 year, indemnity in a reasonable amount shall also be provided for the cost of a midwife licensed in AS 865 who provides the same services. excuse me, indemnity may be provided under the subsection only if the licensed midwife is practicing as a licensed midwife within the scope of the license. Subsection D. If a health care insurance plan or an accepted benefits policy or contract provides for furnishing those services required of a physician in the care of women during preconception, pregnancy, childbirth, and the period after childbirth, and the period after childbirth up to 1 year, the contract shall also provide that a midwife licensed under AS 865 may furnish those same services instead of a physician. Services may be provided under this subsection only if the licensed midwife is practicing as a licensed midwife in accordance with the regulations adopted under AS 865-30, subsections A7, and the services provided within the scope of practice of the license.
We'll take a brief at ease here. Back on the record.
Thank you, Chair. Section 31 amends AS 2184, 335, subsection B15 to add AS 21, 42, 355, subsections A and B. Section 32 amends AS 25, 20, 55, subsection A to add licensed midwives to the protocol that hospitals must follow to assist a single parent and coupled parents regarding their rights and responsibilities and the forms and statements that must be filled out. Section 33 amends AS 25, 20, 55, subsection B to add licensed midwives to the list of medical professionals who must adhere to the same duties described in subsection A 2 through 6 of this section or ensure that an agent performs these duties. Section 34 amends AS 44, 62, 330, A, subsection A36, to rename the Board of Certified Direct Entry to Licensed Midwives. Section 35 amends AS 47, 7, 900 to explain what midwife services are for a licensed midwife. Section 36 amends AS 47, 20, 320, subsection D, to add licensed midwives in this section explaining who shall not be criminally or civilly liable for providing information in good faith to the apartment or its designee. Section 37 repeals AS 8, 65, 60, 8, 65, 70, and 8, 65, 90, subsection B. Section 38 amends uncodified law by adding a new section that reads, transition, continuation of board, subsection A, notwithstanding AS 865-30, as amended by Section 8 of this Act, the members of the Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives, as that board is constituted, under AS 865-30, as that section reads on December 31, 2022, shall operate as the Board of Licensed Midwives from January 1, 2023, until the new members of the Board of the Licensed Midwives are appointed by the governor under Section 39 of this Act and confirmed by the legislature under AS 865-10, as amended by Sections 6 and 7 of this Act. Subsection B. In this section, Board of Licensed Midwives means the Board of Licensed Midwives established by AS 865-10, as amended by Sections 6 and 7 of this Act. Section 39 amends uncodified law by adding a new section that reads, transition, current direct entry midwives and apprentice midwives. Subsection A, notwithstanding AS 865-50, as amended by Section 10 of this Act, a person who holds on December 31, 2022, an unexpired certificate to practice direct entry midwifery issued under AS 865-50, as that section reads on December 31, 2022, is licensed on the effective date of Sections 1 through 40, of this act to practice midwifery under AS 865 as amended by sections 6 through 24 of this act for a two-year period. Subsection B, notwithstanding AS 86590, as amended by section 12 of this act, a person who holds on December 31, 2022, an unexpired permit to practice as an apprentice direct entry midwife issued under AS 86590, as that section reads on December 31, 2022, is permitted on the effective date of sections 1 through 40 of this act to practice as an apprentice midwife under AS 86590, as amended by section 12 of this act for a two-year period. Section 40, the uncodified law of the state of Alaska is amended by adding a new section that reads, transition, new board members, subsection A. Within 60 days after the effective date of sections 1 through 40 of this act, the governor shall appoint an advanced practice registered nurse licensed under AS 868 to be a member of the board to replace the physician member of the board for the remainder of the term of the physician member. Subsection B. Within 60 days after the effective date of sections 1 through 40 of this act, the governor shall appoint an advanced practice registered nurse licensed under AS 68 to be a member of the board to replace the certified nurse midwife member of the board for the remainder of the term of the certified nurse midwife member. Subsection C. The board, as constituted under subsections A and B of this section, shall begin operating as the board when the legislature has confirmed the members appointed under subsections A and B of this section. Subsection D. In this section, board means the Board of Licensed Midwives, established by AS 86510, as amended by sections 6 and 7 of this act. Section 41. The uncodified law of the state of Alaska is amended by adding a new section to read transition regulations. The Board of Direct Entry Midwives, established by AS 86510, as that section reads on December 31, 2022, shall adopt, repeal, or amend regulations as necessary to implement the changes made by sections 1 through 40 of this act. The regulations take effect under AS 4462, the Administrative Procedure Act, but not before January 1, 2023. Section 42 reads, Section 41 of this act takes effect immediately under AS 11070, subsection C. Section 43 reads, except as provided in Section 42 of this act takes effect January 1, 2023. Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee.
Well, thank you, Ms. Bowman. I think that was the longest sectional analysis in the body of this session.
Thank you.
Which is a long, lengthy bill. So, at this time, we will go into a couple of folks that we have online that have been holding to try to get through some of the invited testimony. Those people that are here for public testimony, we will continue public testimony next Thursday to continue on for 192 and for 175. We'll continue public testimony next Thursday on those bills. To start us off on invited testimony, I think we have Rachel Pugh.
Good afternoon, everyone, and thank you for providing me the opportunity to speak on behalf of SB 192. I strongly support this bill and have been directly involved in writing these proposed statute changes for over a year now. These statute changes are necessary in order to comply with the state audit recommendations, but even more importantly, because our current statutes are outdated and create many barriers to access to midwifery care in Alaska. One of the issues is the lack of legal recognition and insurance coverage for CDMs and CPMs based on the wording of current statutes. This outdated language creates insurmountable financial barriers for many. In a recent study across the nation, only 3.4% of hospitals births were paid out of pocket, while 67.9% of planned out-of-hospital births and 32.3% of birth center births were self-pay. In Alaska, 7.9% of all births are planned out-of-hospital births. The national average is 1.6%. The proposed statute changes will not only allow more access to a greater number of Alaskan families to out-of-hospital birth providers, but it will also amend unnecessarily restrictive midwifery practice acts to enable Alaska's midwives to practice at the top of their license according to their full competencies and education. This bill will also ensure that Alaska's midwives will have nationally recognized credentials and be paid at the same level as CNMs and physicians for identical procedures. Studies provide clear evidence that midwifery care, birth center, and home birth settings, including extended prenatal care and postpartum support, provide improved birth outcomes and are highly effective at improving maternal and infant health. If this bill doesn't pass, it will continue to limit and restrict the families of Alaska from having access to the freedom of medical choice and options available to families in more than 35 other states. These proposed statute changes do not endanger the health and safety of a single woman in Alaska. These changes do not mandate any changes to how a midwife currently practices or the type of care they provide. These changes do not limit or restrict a woman of Alaska from being able to choose what type of provider or where she chooses to birth. I'm fighting for the rights of women and families in Alaska to have more options and better access to the type of maternity care that they deserve, not less. I, for one, am tired of turning away women in Alaska in tears as I try to explain why their insurance has denied coverage of a home birth based on current state statutes. I'm tired of having to explain to women why bureaucracy dictates their limited maternity care in Alaska, but if they were in one of many other states, they would have more freedoms of medical choices. I'm also tired of providing care for free, postpartum care and lactation consulting beyond 6 weeks, care that I'm trained and licensed to provide, care that other providers, CNMs, APRNs, and MDs, would be able to bill insurance for, but due to our current statutes, I cannot. Another issue that is currently happening in Alaska is women choosing to have an unassisted birth because Alaska's current statutes and regulations prevented her from hiring a licensed midwife, most often due to insurance coverage and financial barriers. Last year, the board was even notified about a non-licensed rogue midwife allegedly providing care and assistance to women in Alaska due to current restrictive educational and credentialing requirements, as well as current statutes preventing certain insurance providers from covering home births. How is that helping the public health and safety? How is that in the interest of the public? This is a human rights issue. I respectfully ask you to pass this bill as written on behalf of every Alaskan woman, past, present, or future, that was denied access to a midwife based on financial barriers or restrictive and outdated statutes and regulations. Thank you.
Thank you. Any questions for Ms. Pugh? Seeing none, we'll go to Bethel Bedsile. Eli?
Good afternoon. Through the chair, my name is Bethel Bedsile, and I'm a certified direct entry midwife licensed in the state of Alaska, and I'm also a certified professional midwife, which is a nationally recognized designation. I've been a licensed midwife since 1999, and I offer home and birth center practice in Anchorage. I'm also the current chair of the State Board of Certified Direct Entry Midwives, and I have been the chair and on the board since 2020. I want to thank Senator Chair Kawasaki for his support in sponsoring this bill, and with the intention of preserving the rights of Alaska women to have access to safe, out-of-hospital providers and deliveries, and to assure the quality of care they receive and to guarantee insurance coverage for their place of birth. Senate Bill 192 is the completion of a legislative audit that began in 2016. That audit recommended that the board pursue, quote, statutory changes that benefit the public. Sadly, the previous board did not make those changes due to perceived financial concerns. Fiscal year 17 and 19 was noted in the current 2020 audit that, quote, the board identified a need to change certification statutes to align Alaska's midwifery laws with national standards. This audit in 2020 was the year I joined the board and became the chair, and the three concerns listed were that first one, align aligning Alaska laws to national standards. We also were looking at our peer review process and fiscal responsibility. During the last legislative session, we did pass bills for peer review, and our board is now operating in the black. SB 192 is the final piece to completing our audit. SB 192 will align Alaska midwifery laws with the national standard, which is currently the Certified Professional Midwife Standard. It will increase Alaska's fiscal responsibility by placing the burden of vetting midwifery applicants to a national organization, thereby streamlining the in-state process of licensure. It extends well baby visits from 4 weeks to 6 weeks, thus helping to reduce neonatal morbidity. It extends postpartum care to 1 year, again reducing maternal morbidity and mortality by having a trusted provider helping with maternal mental health concerns and giving referrals as needed in the first year of postpartum. It allows for preconception counseling, thereby increasing the health of the next generation of Alaskans. Overall, this bill stands for women's rights to choose where and with whom they feel most comfortable birthing, knowing that their providers are trained to national standards. SB 192 completes this legislative audit by protecting public safety while providing lower childbirth costs, an average 40% lower cesarean rate, less low birth weight babies, and 26% less likely for these babies to be born prematurely. These statute changes have been in the works since 2020, and at our recent board meeting had unanimous approval and voted on by our board. The board understands that change can be hard, but we must protect public safety, and we must abide by the legislative audit. I would appreciate your support on SB 192. Thank you.
Thank you. At this time, we will conclude our business for the day. We will bring this bill aside and hopefully with the bill sponsor scheduled, bring this back up on next week on the 10th. Amendments for 175 are due to our office by March 9th by 5 p.m. Also, a reminder that amendments for SB 156, the prohibited COVID vaccine discrimination amendments, are due to my office by tomorrow at noon. If you can't get those or legislators having issues, please contact our office so we can work out those accommodations. That concludes our business. Our next meeting on Tuesday, we'll be taking up SB 124, mental health facilities, meds. That concludes our business today. Are there any closing comments? I just want to thank folks that held on online. Feel free to also email us public comment at shss.akleg.gov. And that we are adjourned at 3:01 p.m.